CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and we'll launch right into the news, analysis, and interviews that you need for the week ahead in the city. Hello and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor at cityam.com. And as we release this podcast on Monday the 25th, happy Burns Night to any Scots or half Scots or quarter Scots or merely adopted Scots listening. I know there's plenty of them in the city. In a minute, we'll be joined by a deadly duo of former journalists with around 30 years experience on both the business and politics beat. They'll dish out their thoughts on the world right now and the world we're likely to see in the years to come. Susanna Streeter of Hargreaves Lansdown will look at the week ahead, particularly with reference to Biden and what might happen with the Fed. And Steve Hawkes, who was the Sun City correspondent and once 25-1 shot to become governor of Bank of England, according to Ladbrokes Politics, how serious that was, I'll let you decide, will dish on what the British political scene might look like in the years to come. But looking back on last week before we get there, in a world in which turned upside down by COVID-19, it was good old-fashioned corporate news which dominated the airwaves. The ongoing battle to pick up bits of the Arcadia empire took a wild turn with Next, who had been expected to be one of the favourites to pick up at least a decent chunk of Topshop, if nothing else, pulling out of the deal. They and their American hedge fund partners simply saying the price was too steep. And now, on the Sunday newspapers, it looks like ASOS have emerged as the frontrunner to pick up Topshop. Again, though, much like an Australian company that picked up Evans earlier in the process, it looks like ASOS are not that fussed about the stores, rather having the prestige brands to play with online. That will, of course, threaten jobs, and you wonder whether the Treasury and various other bits of the government will be totally thrilled and might well be encouraging ASOS, amongst others, to try and keep some of those flagship stores alive. It was also big news in gambling. MGM, the American conglomerate, had put a bid in for Entain, previously known as GVC, owners of Ladbrokes and Corals, among others. Evidently, some point during the week, they thought it was a bad bet pulling out of the £8 billion offer. Instead, Entain have pulled in a new chief executive, tapping one of their non-executive directors for the role, the first female to run a listed gambling firm in the UK. And frankly, analysts are far more impressed than they were last week by Entain's plans for the future. MGM perhaps have missed out on the deal of the century. But of course, it's still COVID era. Matt Hancock this morning on the Sunday programmes saying that there is still many, many months to come. And I think from a personal perspective, he may well be right. But one thing that government does need to do urgently is clarify when and how we will be out of this first lockdown. We all understand, of course, that restrictions will be around for a very long time. It's unlikely we're going to be having house parties of 80 people in mid-March. But surely there has to be a case for relaxing the very strictest lockdown restrictions as more people are vaccinated. Anyway, a question for another day and a question that markets will no doubt be asking for many months to come. We'll move straight in now to Susanna Streeter, Chief Markets Watcher at Hargreaves Lansdown and former BBC Business presenter for around 20 years. Susanna's been on the podcast before and was a star. Susanna, wonderful to have you back.
Lovely to be here.
I think both of us and indeed much of the world watched events in Washington this week as a sort of changing of the guard in DC, but the almost a changing of the guard right across the world, America's leadership being such a unique version of it for the past 4 years, both economically and politically. Perhaps a return to something more like we've been used to for a long time. But although we'll all probably remember the inauguration for a while, and indeed Donald Trump's farewell speech, it's sort of eyes turned to next week, really. We've got the first Fed decision. I mean, what's your impression of what city watchers are keeping an eye on across the pond as we move into sort of the first few days of the Biden presidency?
Well, it's really interesting what you're talking about there, about a bit of a new normal returning. And in fact, I certainly think we're going to see that. between this administration and the Federal Reserve. We're not going to see, I doubt it anyway, late night tweets berating the Fed for not shifting to negative rates and not doing more to promote growth, economic growth. Certainly we saw under the Trump era. And in fact, the very fact that the new Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, is a former Federal Reserve chairman, I think there's going to be a lot smoother relationship between the White House and at the Federal Reserve. And you talked, Andy, about, of course, the inauguration that so many of us watched. And there was that real Biden bounce, that optimism washing through financial markets. But that has begun to ebb away because of those fears about the long-term impact of COVID on the US economy. And that is going to be concentrating minds at the Federal Reserve as well. There is expectation that interest rates will be kept near zero throughout 2021 into next year, and that a QE will be kept on track, huge amounts of bond buying going on until they reach the target for maximum employment. And with the unemployment numbers we're getting through, that doesn't look likely anytime soon. And of course, as well, we have rising inflation, which is concerning some, and that is all going to be in the mix. We've also got some indications from the Beige Book survey showing that certainly many districts are still in decline, those federal districts which they analyse to work out policy. So the economic picture is pretty bleak, and I think that will mean that its policies will stay on track.
Yeah, and speaking of, we'll jump back across the pond in a minute, but on this very swift Concorde-esque flight back across the Atlantic, you talk about the economic picture being pretty bleak. UK PMIs released on Friday, pretty grim, a lot bleaker than I think most economists predicted. And just briefly, we've talked about central bank decision-making, but Rishi Sunak's got a decision to make as well. We come up to the budget on March 3rd.
Absolutely. Of course, those readings were grim, even though they did show that, in fact, the third lockdown, like the second, has been less damaging for the economy compared to the first lockdown in March, April. They were pretty dismal. And I think that it does mean that January's fall in GDP is likely to be deeper than first thought, meaning the economy will take longer to recover. In addition to this, we've had other readings out as well, retail sales figures for December showing just how tough it remains for many sectors. Those last minute lockdowns before Christmas really came as a bitter blow and only reversed at a tiny part of the 4.1% fall triggered by those shutdowns in November. And of course, public borrowing has risen yet again in the UK by just over 34 billion in December, despite a rise in tax revenues. Now, all of this really does underline just how fragile the economy is and how in need of support the economy is. And I think that's going to add pressure on the Chancellor not to increase taxes significantly at the budget, because many believe that actually the economy just can't withstand that. Those tax rises they're brought in, some people are saying they should be brought in further down into 2021. And certainly I would agree with that. I do think that it's inevitable that we will see some incremental tax rises to help support some of the poorest members in society, and tax rises on perhaps capital gains tax, inheritance tax, a whole raft of wealth taxes, perhaps the upper rate of pensions as well. So I think they will come in, but I think there's going to be increasing pressure not for them not to come in quite so early.
I think you're right. And whether the economy can withstand it or otherwise, I think there's the political landscape also dictates that tax rises will be very, very difficult to push through, no matter the circumstances right now, when you think about those red wall seats that the Tories are so desperate to hold on to. We're going to speed back across the Atlantic with all the speed of a Hyperloop, and you'll like what I've done there, and discuss big results, big updates this week from Tesla and Apple. Lots of people seem to think they're still a little, very frothy, and that valuations are, we're talking about valuations that even 10 years ago people wouldn't have necessarily conceived of.
Absolutely. I mean, people would be very wise only to hold Tesla as part of a well-diversified portfolio, of course, and actually to trim some profits now, because we've seen this astronomical rise in the share price of Tesla. Now, Tesla did come in just shy of its production target last year, 500,000 vehicles, which is a significant achievement given its previous production hitches, of course. But the valuation just remains eye-watering at around 202 times forward earnings. Now, a 13% rise in the share so far this year. I've also seen the CEO, Elon Musk, of course, are becoming the richest person in the world. But these key questions remain about, can the group sustain the high levels of production needed without incurring additional costs? And to get even close to justifying its share price, Tesla is going to have to grow really fast and consistently hit quarterly sales production numbers going forward. And also, this is really crucial to look at as well. Sales of regulatory credits also account for a really hefty proportion of total revenues and cash at the moment. And as rivals manufacture new electric vehicles, the market for these credits is going to fall, putting more pressure on the core business of selling cars. And so even a whiff of a problem going forward, so be interested to see what this trading statement comes up with, could really be painful and could lead to the share price falling. So for the moment, though, Tesla remains its lead, but it is a luxury item. And as more people take part in the e-car revolution, I think they're going to want lower priced cars. And that is going to have an issue for Tesla going forward.
And Apple as well, we get the quarterly update this week on Wednesday. There's some analysts predicting they could be looking at sales of more than $100 billion in a single quarter for the first time in its history.
That would be really remarkable and go some way to justifying its valuation as well. But remember, Apple is still very much a hardware business, despite all of this much trumpeted growth in its services branch. So it was going to be really interesting to find out whether sales of hardware are keeping up, because there has been a lot of fanfare around its offerings like Apple Music, Apple TV, Apple News, Apple Arcade, Apple Fitness, which have all been gathered together into the Apple One bundle. But this product line is, of course, really dependent on people continuing to buy Apple devices. And as the differences between rival smartphones become more difficult to detect, there is greater potential for competitors to gobble up market share, which then will have an impact on this fast-growing services division. And iPhone sales have been rather lackluster, because really people aren't replacing their handsets quite so quickly. But perhaps the new 5G-enabled models will translate into higher sales. So it's going to be really interesting to watch just the growth rates between services and also hardware, and really whether its high valuation is justified.
It's funny, I remember just at the end of 2020 there, we were doing some work for the site around, you know, companies and their share prices over 2020. And we tried to put Tesla on the graph, and unfortunately basically broke the graph, because the scale that it needed was so far off any other kind of company that we ended up scrapping the whole thing. Looking back at a company that is, well, we all very much know what it does. We get first half updates from Diageo this week. I think 2020 drove most of us into our own coping mechanisms. And for many, no doubt, it was Talisker and Johnny Walker and various other bits and pieces. Unsurprisingly, very, very tough financial year ending in June 2020. Analysts expecting a bit of a bounce this year, but it's a fascinating company, really, because throughout this whole process, they've continued to look at expanding. They've continued investing. They picked up Ryan Reynolds' aviation gin last year for a $610 million.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I find it fascinating, the kind of celebrity branding. Is it going to fall off at some point? But anyway, yeah, they certainly still think as though that's a great avenue to go down. And yes, it has been such a tough year for the distiller. The pandemic forcing bars and pubs around the world to close their doors, and sales took a predictable hit. And it's also the very fact that the group has really large fixed costs dragging down profit. We're not going to get growth, I think, given the other recent waves of lockdowns, but it's just whether the group can keep that ability to spring back into action really quickly. It's going to be down, of course, to the worldwide vaccine rollouts, whether or not hospitality can open up, just how soon hospitality can open up and people go out socializing once more. Once they can do, I certainly do think that there is going to be party time, because people, this pent-up demand for wanting to socialize once more and have a good time. Actually, what's also interesting is that Fevertree results are out as well. And they've really managed to keep a fear surrounding the brand, despite, again, a really challenging period, partly because they've been really successful in shifting to at-home sales, with home cocktail hour proving a real tonic for lockdown drinkers. And that really has offset the decline in the bar and pub sector. And I don't think Diageo have been quite so successful in doing that, with people possibly opting for kind of supermarket brand spirits instead. But certainly Fever-Tree have managed to keep demand going, even though they also have taken a real hit because bars and pubs have closed right across the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Fever-Tree famed for an absolutely brilliant slogan. What was it when they sort of first launched? If three quarters of your gin and tonic is tonic, make sure you've got the right one. And I remember I was still working when Fever-Tree kind of first emerged, before I went into journalism. I was still working as a bar manager in South London. I remember my publican seeing that, my governor, and saying, if three quarters of your gin and tonic is tonic, you're doing it wrong, which always amused me to this day. And of course, Diageo will also be looking forward to the return of duty-free travel and people flying across the world, because so many of their high-end whiskies in particular do very, very well in those, when we're all in captive audiences in airports for an hour and a half. What I would do to be stuck in an airport for a few hours, I have to say.
Absolutely. What would we all do? I know. But it's interesting, the premiumization trend hasn't waned really as far as tonics are concerned, but has it waned as far as the actual spirits are concerned? It's interesting to see whether we'll see an examination of those trends in these trading statements coming out next week. But yeah, I mean, Fever-Tree, it's got competition now. There's a skinny tonic being launched, so I wonder whether that will eat into sales.
And on celebrity booze or not, Spencer Matthews has just raised $7 million for his clean liquor, as they call it, extremely low alcohol version of gins.
Yes, and those Hollywood actresses launching their own wine ranges as well. That's become a bit of a trend.
Everybody's getting into it. Well, we can all look forward to enjoying some of them, hopefully on holiday at some point in the second half of 2021. Susanna, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susanna, again. And now we'll turn to the second in our deadly duo of former journalists, to tabloid legend Steve Hawkes, former city editor at The Sun over the course of the global financial crisis, and then deputy political editor at The Sun, as well as some time at The Telegraph and The Times. Steve, pleasure to have you on.
No problem. Pleasure to be here, Andy.
And indeed, you were also, as I recall, tipped in 2012 by a certain Mervyn King to take the governor of the Bank of England job, which eventually went to Mark Carney.
I know, it was a close-run thing. Unfortunately, the Mervyn King in question was the darts legend, Mervyn King, who we got to know at The Sun because I used him also to talk about interest rates once. But back in the day...
He knew his numbers, presumably.
Yeah, I think it was quite a good piece of it. He didn't say that much, so we had to prise the information out of him. But he thought, oh, let's cut rates because, yeah, we'll could all do with a bit more money, was his view.
And greater analysis won't get. Now, obviously, head of strategic media at BCW, but yeah. Just looking back on that time as a hack in the city from 2008 to 2013, you look at, you know, obviously where we are right now, an awful lot of people like to look back at the global financial crisis as a kind of playbook, I guess, for getting out of a pandemic-induced crash. But they're very different things, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, I mean, obviously we talk a lot, and you look at this last year, when the pandemic first struck and Rishi Sunak started to bail out certain sectors and started introducing furlough, etc. It really did give me a flashback to, you know, the credit crisis when there were the government schemes that sort of bail out the banks and the companies that became casualties. And there did seem a lot of similarities. You know, you had Joel Hills, the individuals are the same, like Joel Hills at ITN, who was at Sky at the time, Robert Peston, he was a big journalist during the credit crisis on the business side. Now on the political side, there were just so many similarities. But I think the way this has evolved, I think it's just, I think there will be a similarity in the way, but we'll have to see what happens. When the support comes away this time, I think we'll see, unfortunately, what happened at the credit crisis as well. I think we'll see a lot more businesses. My fear is that we'll see a lot more businesses collapse after the pandemic. You know, the credit crisis, we saw it during the credit crisis, and it was the sort of, playbook of a recession and a sort of L-shaped recovery. I think we'll see a V-shaped recovery, when finally we can get back outdoors again. I think you'll see that demand surge and you'll see people, jetting off abroad. You'll see people going down the shops, down the pub, et cetera, et cetera. But I think after that, perhaps we'll see a W. I think there will be, my fear is there will be a dip after that initial relief surge as such. But I mean, to your point, I mean, the credit crisis, I mean, that was all about the money supply drying up as such, and this time there isn't that problem as such. There's money everywhere. It's just there's no way of spending it.
Mm. So I guess the hope that Rishi Sunak has, which may be why we're all deterred from going abroad for a long time, is that all of that pent-up demand goes straight into the home economy and sort of powers growth. But as you say, there are so many businesses that are already on the mat that are basically relying on this support to survive. And unless the economy kind of kicks back into life on day one in pretty much the same form that it was, on day minus one way back in February 2020, some of those companies are really going to struggle once that support is pulled away.
I mean, you want to be optimistic about it all, and, I think there will be a grounds for optimism. But I think what coronavirus seems to have done in my mind, I think, is it's accelerated change that was always going to happen. I think, the fundamental change that was always going to happen in, say, the way we shop, unfortunately, also the way we consume news, the way we travel. And I think coronavirus has basically accelerated this change. Unfortunately, you guys have seen that at CityAM. We've seen it in newspapers everywhere. We've seen it on the high street. I mean, the fact that Topshop, for example, could be struggling, could be in administration, that sort of thing. You wouldn't have believed that a while ago. I mean, so the one area where we're spending money at the moment is Amazon, and Amazon going crazy. I mean, there's delivery lorries everywhere dropping off cardboard boxes, that. And I think it's hard to see, the shift going back from that. And so I think there's going to be winners and losers. And yeah, we're going to be spending money as a nation afterwards, just for the sheer fact that we can go out, take the family out, eat out, go abroad. There will be a recovery, but it'd be interesting. There's going to be winners and losers.
It's so interesting when you talk about Amazon as well, because we think of, everything going digital, so to speak, and, the high street, et cetera. But those things still need to sit in warehouses. There still need to be those delivery drivers. There still need to be cardboard boxes to put them in. It's quite a funny sort of thing that the digital retail revolution has ended with the most kind of mundane, to a certain degree, kind of items, delivery vans, warehouses, and cardboard boxes becoming at the heart of the retail economy.
Yeah, and this will be one of the arguments that the government is going to have to when it gets round to it, settle on business rates, for example. I always remember Justin King at Sainsbury's, and this was probably after the credit crisis, talking about how, and this was one of the arguments that came out of the credit crisis, because at the time then, everyone was talking about how the financial crisis was going to shake up the system. There was going to be a massive change. There's going to have to be a change. George Osborne was saying, we're going to have to rebalance the economy. But then briefly, he saw the pain that was going to cause electorally and forgot about it and relied on the consumer again. And I think now on business rates, for example, Justin King's argument was always, the likes of Amazon, they don't pay business. They pay business rates on their parks, but they're not in high value places. So they get quite a low bill from that. But yet their vans will use the roads that we all pay for example, and there is that question about recycling, but it's a superb business. And so I think the government's going to have to look at all this sort of stuff going forward and think about how it's got a lot of issues to address going forward, really, on the tax system as one of them.
Yeah, well, there's also, there are myriad calls for reform, and maybe it's the sort of the pandemic and the economic hit is just the shock that the Treasury needs, really, maybe, to think about those kind of sweeping reforms. But just very quickly, because we'll kind of talk about Britain in the world and what its place with Biden and various others in a sec, but just very briefly, with your kind of political hat on, do you think Rishi Sunak has any scope to put up taxes in March or April, or do you think he's going to have to wait? Because my instinct is that neither politically nor economically he's got the space to do that right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. You remember when David Cameron and George Osborne came in, obviously with a little bit of Nick Clegg as well, that you would have thought they had a blank sheet of paper. They could have done anything they wanted because, it's hard to remember now, but they came in on a ticket of, right, let's sort this out. Let's make sure this never happens again. Let's do what we can. But they really didn't deliver on that. And I think now, what with Brexit and COVID, you've got, in a way, the perfect chance. We've hit control out delete, right, in every sense. So you basically can rebuild. And this whole thing about build back better, build back greener. Well, if you're going to do that, then let's do it properly. So there's talk about, Boris saying he wants after Brexit to be Singapore, basically a Singapore of Europe or whatever. So there's a blank sheet of paper where they could do anything they want. And I suppose the fear is that they won't do as much as they can, because, as you've pointed out, because of the huge debts we've got. and also because they're worried about votes. But I think it would be a shame if they didn't grasp this opportunity, I think, to fundamentally redraw where we are and what we're going to do and what we're going to be about. That might mean tax increases. And I think most families would kind of understand that if it was done in the right way. And I know we're going to get onto this, but the one interesting area, well, of course, is green taxes. Because, I mean, I think we're going to quickly pivot media-wise onto the environment. Say March, April time, there's going to be wall-to-wall environment, wall-to-wall COP26, net zero, race to zero. And the government has to have a pretty big conversation with the public about how much that's going to cost. And in theory, I mean, coming back to my time at The Sun, 2011, we campaigned on freezing fuel duty. And it was frozen every year from then. And you would imagine that this would be the perfect chance for Rishi to lift that freeze. And to, it pains me to say that, obviously, from the campaign we had. But you can see why he might want to do that, because he needs to encourage people onto other forms of transport, and he needs to raise money, and he needs to send a signal about how attitudes and the ways of living are going to have to change. But I doubt he will.
Well, yeah, not least because he's going to have Boris Johnson looking at his electoral map from 2019 and seeing a lot of seats in parts of the country where people do drive and where, you know, alternative modes of transport aren't where you'd want them to be. Yeah, let's talk about COP26, which is approaching at speed now. As you say, sort of post-pandemic, we're probably going to move straight into that. It's a massive set piece for Boris. It's a massive set piece, really, for sort of post-Brexit Britain. I think a lot of the kind of world, the global narrative, especially if you read certain other publications and CEM, is that Britain's kind of turning inward, that it's going to go backward, that it's all about this sort of pining for empire. For Boris, this is a massive chance for him to say that actually brand Britain is, you know, progressive 21st century, blah, 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 blah. But as you say, there's going to come with costs. So I guess as we head towards that, where does business fit in? Because there seems to have been, to me, in the last couple of years at least, a realization in the city that actually if London in particular can grasp the mettle on this early, if it can be the global leader in green finance, etc., there is certainly money to be made there.
Yeah, I think green finance, to your point, it seems to be front and center of everything. That, yeah, whenever I speak to government, or you speak to people who speak to government, you speak to people who speak to business, green finance is everywhere, you know, in terms of a topic. And I think there was, from memory, Mark Carney was speaking at a green finance summit last November, I believe. And there's going to be another international investor summit, I think, in the run-up to COP. And that's a big part of their program. So to your point, yes, absolutely. And I think from the conversations you have, business seems to be aware of its responsibility here. And ministers certainly believe that businesses are already on board. Alex Sharma, I know, has this view that if business doesn't act, they will be pressurized to change by people like Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion, etc. So business needs to act now. This is their chance. And I think also he views it as good. It's good for business. You know, emissions have come down, say, last 20 years, but everyone would agree that growth has still happened. And also there is that, to that point, I think this will be the interesting dynamic. I think also for tabloids going forward, like, you know, The Sun, The Mail, etc., how do their readers, I mean, I saw a figure recently where I think 82% of Sun readers said, you know, they wanted to do more about being green, being greener as such. But, you know, will they do that when it costs more? And so I think business will see it as it's good business. It's good business to be environmentally friendly. It's good business to join the race to zero. And it'd be interesting, though, to see with business, are they really meaningful change? You know, BP's made a big, big, big pledge on the environment, and it will upset, you know, the business and the traditional element of the business. It's made a huge commitment. And I think if more business does that, there will be meaningful change going forward, and the government will be very happy with that.
Yeah, and investors are clearly going to be driving a large part of that as well. And of course, climate change is the other element of COP, is that it will be another moment at which the US and the UK are probably more closely aligned, especially now with the new president, than they the many other of the kind of globally leading powers. Boris will clearly see that as a chance to cozy up to Biden. We've already had the seemingly four-yearly controversy over whether or not Winston Churchill's bust is in the Oval Office or not, started by a friend of ours, Tim Shipman, back in 2009. But, you know, where do you think government from your conversations and what you kind of just think from being around it for so long, where do you think Britain's kind of ins with the Biden administration are? And do you think that this hope for a sort of special relationship, and I don't mean turning into a trade deal overnight, because I think that's going to take an awfully long time to get there. But, you know, in terms of Britain's relationship with the US, it seems like there are some ins that Boris could capitalize on.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, much has been written about, you know, Joe Biden and seeing Boris as another version of Trump and such like. But look, I mean, this, you know, the two countries have to get on. There is that special relationship. And I think there's far more that goes on than we will ever know in terms of intelligence and that sort of thing. And look, I think Joe Biden might want to give Boris a cold shoulder for a bit, but he knows they're going to have to come to the table. And I mean, Alex Sharma was saying how he spoke to John Kerry. And I think in terms of COP26 is concerned, those two are going to work very, very closely together. I mean, Alex Sharma knows he needs to deliver 60 to 70 countries, you know, to commit to a new binding target, you know, by the time COP26 starts for it to be a success. And I think John Kerry and Joe Biden would like to see America being a fundamental driver behind that as well. So there's a mutual interest there already. I think Boris Johnson is obsessed about Green Britain. I think given the tough time he's had personally over the past year, he perhaps sees Green Britain as his legacy, then very strong to his own personal brand, because it has taken a battering. And, you know, he's far more of a one nation Tory than many, many people think. You know, many people took a view on him after Brexit. But I think he's more of a one-nation Tory, and he'll be very into this. So there is mutual territory there. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Joe Biden perhaps goes to, he might do something like go to Europe before he comes to London or something. I don't know, but I'm sure that relationship will prevail. And there's going to be sure business will be driving that as well. There's going to be a lot of transatlantic business that will still take place that will help, you know, build that mutual friendship or rebuild it. I mean, I think, you know, that this sort of stuff's always going to happen. I remember, you know, Trump is very, very of the moment now to ridicule Donald Trump, and, you know, with some reason. But, you know, 4 years ago, people were in awe of the guy because he was the US president and he was an intimidating presence. And, like, you know, so, but then we move on. And like, you know, if you look at the quotes from the PM's official spokesperson yesterday, you know, refusing to be drawn into the row about whether Joe Biden was woke or not. And, you know, we move on, we turn the page, and I think we remain friends with whoever it is.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's too much to ask. Look, Steve, we'll leave it there. But before we go, I just want to ask you one quick question, which will be of interest to some of our listeners, albeit not all. You and I, of course, big American football fans, both of us, sort of bonded many a time over watching it. Conference championships this weekend. Who have you got, Rodgers or Brady? Bucks versus Packers.
Well, I haven't done very well in predicting this so far over the playoffs, but I mean, it comes down to, I suppose, who I'd like to. I mean, I'd love Rodgers to be there. I'd love Green Bay to win that one.
Yeah, me too.
I think the Tampa Bay defense might be too strong, but no, it'd be nice for Green Bay to do it, I think.
And the best thing about this, Steve, is that we're recording it on a Friday. This will be out on a Monday, so we'll find out whether you're right or wrong, buddy.
I'll put the curse on them, I'm sure.
Steve, pleasure to have you join us and kind of share some thoughts in the last few years, and we'll speak again, I'm sure.
No, thanks for having me. Definitely, thank you.
That was Steve Hawkes, Fleet Street legend, and now head of strategic media at BCW Global. And before that, Susanna Streeter, who was the star of business TV for 20-odd years at the BBC. That's all from us at City AM. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. We'll be back next week as ever. Last thing to say on this Monday the 25th is Happy Burns Night. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, all the news, analysis and opinion you need will be on cityam.com.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.